Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons. I, as always, am Jason Ophir, here with Sherry Pang. Sherry, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you, Jason?
Not too bad. It's been an eventful week, and it seems to be I've just had a bunch of uneventful weeks, so that's a good thing. How was your week?
Very good. I was on a show, and I'm going to be busy this week, and just life is, I wouldn't say crazy. It's just going to be very eventful, doing readings, and, you know, it's just, I feel very blessed. And, it's with the Mercury retrograde, I don't know about you, and I'm not really into the suns and the stars or anything, but, man, people are getting kind of weird. It's kind of hokey and energies and the new kind of life of dealing with who people are on a soul level. And I don't know. I think things are shifting to a point you're going to find your soul group and get about a, you know, people are splitting up as far as, you know, things that are, you would hang out with or acquaintances, and things are just really shifting around. I don't know about you, Jason, but as old as I'm getting, I'm becoming more discerning in who I let in my inner circle.
Well, I haven't noticed anything terribly unusual. One thing I did notice, and you know I've mentioned it before, I think there's something going on in this basement. I have like this basement apartment thing. And one thing I did notice this week was the other day I left the door into my basement room open with the light on. And I do that so I can see at night because I work really late at night. And I came home and the door was completely closed, and I know there's nobody here, and I know for a fact it was open. So maybe there was a change in air pressure. I don't know, but it got me thinking because there's something weird going on down here.
So I suppose that one of these days I need to go over there and check it out for you, right?
Yeah, I'd appreciate it. There's like,
he's probably playing
really
hide and go seek.
I think it's ghosts. Yeah, probably.
Are you sure it's not a poltergeist?
I haven't noticed any poltergeist activity, but, you know, like I've mentioned before, whatever it is, if it's anything, it seems to stay out of my living space and in this one dark, creepy corner. And I know that it's not necessarily my imagination, because I had mentioned previously that somebody had come to do work on the house, and it happened to be in that corner that I just get this creepy vibe. And the worker told the house owner that he would never come back because of that corner. So who knows?
Yeah, no matter. Yeah, that's going to be quite interesting. Well, you're pretty much immune to it, aren't you?
Pretty much.
Oh,
I try and ignore
crazy.
It.
Hey, I just want to let everybody know we have a very special guest, and she's a returning guest. It's always a joy to have her. Love her energy. She has brought so much information, and this lady is dynamite. I have a lot of respect for her and a lot of love for her. She is amazing. Andrea Perrone, a lot of you may not know who she is, but you probably may know about the show with this box office hit called The Conjuring. And Andrea, The Conjuring is based on the family of, I believe, five siblings. I think Andrea can correct me on that if I'm wrong, but it's based on five girls, I believe, and how the different turn of events in their lives were changed forever when they moved into this old farmhouse. And so Andrea is the oldest of the siblings. She very talented author. She's just amazing, very well known in the paranormal arena. She travels all over the country, and we are very, very fortunate to have her back on the show. So we're going to talk about specifically about her new movie called The Conjuring, which is going to be her take of it. And also, I'm going to ask some questions about her experiences and what she can share and what she can tell our listeners of the different lessons that she's had living in those type of experiences with her family. So go ahead, Jason, bring her on.
Andrea, how are you?
Hi, Jason.
Oh, I'm sick as a dog. How are you?
Oh, no.
But
I saw that. You could barely function, huh?
Oh, my God. It's been so bad. And this is twice now this year that I've been very ill.
Oh, my God. I can feel like a Mack truck.
Oh, no, it's okay. I mean, we booked this interview 2 months ago. There was no way any of us could have known that I would have gotten on a plane in Nevada and by the time I got back to Orlando, been infected with disease from a two-year-old child that was sitting next to my father and myself on the flight. He's getting through the worst of it now, and I'm in the throes. And ruined his Thanksgiving. He spent the whole day sleeping. I think I got one bowl of Italian wedding soup in him from this feast. You know, it was, we spent the day with our friend Josie, and she's the mother of the man who's going to direct my films. And his name is James Moran. And he's well known in the industry. And interestingly, Josie and her son James grew up in a house. He grew up in a house in Bristol, Rhode Island, which is at the southern part of our little tiny state. And at the same time that we were living at the farm, and it wasn't until like 40 years later that my father met her, and I met her. And found out that her son is a film director and that his genre is the paranormal. So, boom, you know, once we met, it's just everything has exploded into place to make these movies. The Conjuring was a good movie. I'm not trying to make The Conjuring again. It was a good movie for what it was, but it was method and it was formula and it was what people expected a good horror movie to be. We are making three films that correspond with the three volumes of our story, and it's called House of Darkness, House of Light, and that will be the name of all three films with a corresponding subtitle for each one. And the first one is House of Darkness, House of Light, and So It Begins. And it's going to blow people's minds. I'm telling
that
both of you.
That gives me the chills, Andrea, just when you just said that. Oh, my gosh.
This is going to be, I have the team of people ever assembled to make films. And every one of them just dropped into my lap in the same way that all the pieces of the cosmic puzzle had to fall into place when we lived in Cumberland to catapult us to the farm. Everything had to happen, as you well know, because you're so familiar with the story. In Volume 1, it doesn't start at the farmhouse. Volume 1 begins in Cumberland, Rhode Island, before we ever moved to the farmhouse, because an entire series of events had to transpire precisely the way that they did, in the exact order that they did, for us to end up with that farm. And we were supposed to move with that farm, and we were supposed to stay there for the 10 years that we lived there. And then 30 years later, I was supposed to tell the story to the world when the world was ready to hear it. And now the world is ready for these films. Now they are. And this isn't going to be a bunch of CGI and special effects and all of, you know, all the hocus pocus that and to his credit, James Wan didn't really go there either with The Conjuring. You know, he made it really true to its time in the 70s, as close as he could get, and he didn't cheat. He didn't use, you know, this isn't supposed to be Transformers, you know, but this is about transformation. This is about spiritual transformation and going from being a perfectly normal family to a perfectly paranormal family within moments of moving to that farmhouse.
Isn't it funny how things fall into place? Like, it makes me think that there's some sort of grand design with, you know, the universe and our lives when things kind of slide into place. But I'm really excited when those come out to see them, because I think last time you were on, we talked about it. I kind of get disillusioned with horror movies because, you know, they're designed and they're formulated to scare people with jump scares. I want to see a movie that isn't, you know, Hollywoodized with, like you said, special effects, because I don't believe you need that to tell a scary story.
No, you don't. And I'll also tell you that in the same way that my books do not fall into the horror genre, these films are not going to be horror movies. You know, yes, there were some horrific things that happened at the farm. Yes, there were some very frightening things that happened to every member of my family. But, you know, the title of the books and the title of the film is what it is for a reason. There were many wonderful moments. It was a house of darkness, but also a house of light and enlightenment. And I consider it the best 10 years of my life, because in that decade, I learned everything I needed to know about life and death and the afterlife. And I have been able to live my life free of fear of death because of it, because I know it's not a matter of belief or faith or, you know, thinking, just maybe, you know, conceptualizing that there is something beyond our mortal existence. I know that there is. And so I can live very comfortably and peacefully in that knowledge. And I try to impart that knowledge to anybody that's open to it or, you know, willing to listen. And I don't try to convince anybody of anything. Everyone is free to believe exactly what they want to, whatever gets you through it, you know. But to me, I think there's nothing more liberating than knowing that death is not the end. It's not ashes to ashes, dust to dust. That has nothing to do with anything except the vessel. And the vessel
and
dies.
And of all the things that were happening to you and your family, I'm sure that, you know, at first, I imagine that there are times where I imagine you were feeling like you didn't know what was coming next. How did you cope with that? Did you write? How were you able to not know what's going to happen when things were, you know, flying off the shelves, or things were happening with your sisters or your mom and your dad and things like that? How were you able to cope with a situation like that?
Well, we were children, and children are incredibly resilient and resourceful. We just didn't know any better. We got used to it. It's no different than living a normal life where you don't know what's coming from moment to moment, day to day. You don't know what, you know, if some bully in a classroom is going to cause a problem, or, you know, your dog's going to get hit by a car. You don't know. I mean, there's terrible things and wonderful things that happen in everybody's life every day, if they're living at all. So, to me, I guess it's different, but it's not. I can't really explain this. I'm not doing a good job. It could be the NyQuil. But what I'm trying to say here is that I don't believe in the paranormal. I don't believe in the word paranormal or the word supernatural. I think that if something exists, it's normal. And if something exists, it's natural. And it's just different than what our normal perceptions pick up. You know, but we had to learn very quickly that we were living in shared space. We had to learn very quickly to adapt to our situation. And several of us were so young that remember much of life before moving to the farm. So, you know, April was only 5 years old when we moved there. She was just a little cherub. And and she and I was 12. So, you know, Cindy was 8, had just turned 8. Christine was 10, and Nancy wasn't even 11 yet. I think we moved at the time between, yeah, Nancy and Christine are only 11 months apart. It's a Catholic thing. Don't get me going. So we moved there when, yeah, we were all just little kids, and we started seeing things that we had never seen before, hearing things, feeling things, sensing things. Smelling things that were disgusting, you know, the smell of death in the house. And you kind of knew when it got cold and it got stinky that you should get gone. from a room or a situation. But it was normal to us because we didn't really have that much to compare it to. At least my youngest sisters didn't. And yet, you know something, I have to tell you this. I'm so grateful that we had the experiences that we had, because my baby sister April died in March of this year. And she was only 51, only a couple of weeks away from her 52nd birthday. And if I hadn't had the experiences, if we as a family had not had the experiences that we did growing up in that farm, I don't know if I would be able to connect with her now from the other side the way that I do, the way that we all do. Because once you're touched by spirit, it opens a door in you that you can't ever close. And April just walks through it, you know, of her own free will, of her own volition, and has all of us know over and over and over again that she's right here. She's right with us. And I can't imagine feeling, not believing or not knowing what I do and not being able to connect with her and having to live the rest of my life feeling a vacancy that doesn't really exist.
No. You had mentioned the scents a little bit ago. Is anytime I've heard of like people smelling sulfur or rotting flesh, it's always been referred to as demonic. Is that true, or is that just watching too many ghost hunting TV shows?
Well, you know, it really depends on who you talk to. I don't know if demons exist. I've never seen a demon. I know that there's evil in the world, that we live in a dualism that we cannot deny, and you know, good and evil as concepts exist, but they're absolutely intangible, and the only way that we're able to discern them and identify them and then consequently label them, which is our proclivity to do as human beings, is to see the manifestation of the concept in the same way that we see the manifestation of love in myriad ways. We can also see evil. We can see acts that are abhorrent to us and to our nature, our intrinsic nature to love. I think that's the true human condition, is to love. But I also think that the opposite of love is not hatred, but is fear. And I think that hatred is born of fear, actually.
That makes sense.
You know, so I look at it this way. You know, we had a very interesting, unique upbringing in that respect. I mean, we grew up and lived in a house that the land to build the house was deeded in 1680. You know, this is one of the original colonial homes in America that has survived. It's a marvel of architecture, and just a big old farmhouse that was cold in the winter and hot in the summer, and had a personality all its own, but is riddled with supernatural activity, if you want to label it as such. And I think that the reason is because it's just been around so long. I mean, 8 generations of one extended family lived and died in that house prior to our arrival. And a lot of them either come and go as they please, or they're still there in some way, shape, or form, whether it be residual energy. But most of them are absolutely benign, and I would even venture to say benevolent. There was one spirit in the house that had a profound dislike for my mother. I would say hatred. And she lusted after my father, and she coveted us, the children. Would I label her a demon? No. I think that when we cross over, we take, you know, virtually all the elements of our characters and our personalities with us. And somebody that was hateful and had issues in life is going to have the same issues on the other side, whether they, you know, were not, if they were left unresolved in death, or if somebody died so quickly before so traumatically that they're not even sure that they're dead, but that their energy can, you know, there are, I think there are multiple dimensions that exist simultaneously. So, you know, we saw things in that house that would lead me to believe in terms of quantum mechanics and quantum physics that there are numerous dimensions that we, there were times when we could look into the past and what was in the past was looking at us in the future, where contact was made interdimensionally. That's wild stuff. That's like you have to suspend your disbelief in order to wrap your mind around it. You have to suspend your notion of linear time to even comprehend some of the stuff that happened in that house. And I tell people all the time in my lectures, you know, I can't say that if I hadn't lived it, if I hadn't seen it, if I hadn't journaled about it for a decade plus, if I hadn't experienced what I have in this life, I can't say that I would believe our own story. It almost requires some contact with an individual, not just fascination per se, but it almost, it's like I wrote these books for people that have already been touched by spirit, and it's a validation and it's a liberation for them.
Now, let me ask you, this is kind of deep, but I think most people are kind of like myself, you know, where we fear death. And because we fear the unknown, and you were fortunate enough to experience spirit to kind of get over that hump. But for people like me that are still plagued with those sort of fears, how do we get those experiences to get touch with spirit so that we can overcome the fear of death and stuff like that? Is there anything you can do, or are we just kind of at the mercy of the universe and that sort of thing?
Well, I cannot tell you that I think that in terms of resolving your own personal fears, Jason, you're barking up the wrong tree. You're trying to find some validation outside of yourself when there is already a plethora of evidence. And because you work in this field, you've already seen all of it or a good part of it, I'm sure. And you know that there's something. In terms of dealing with your fear, I would suggest an entirely different path. And what I would suggest to you is that you embrace that fear and you love that fear because it's part of who you are and part of your humanity, and specifically embrace your own fear of death. Because, Jason, you're going to die. All of us are going to die. And we don't know if it's tomorrow or if it's 50 years from now. We don't know. But we all do know that we're going to die. And when you accept that, when you, on a visceral, subliminal, subconscious, internal way, take that in and truly accept it and embrace it, not because you want to die tomorrow, but because no matter what your life has been, just that you've had it has been grand, no matter how long. The whole notion of this helped me deal with April's passing because I thought, you know, damn it, she was too young. She was too young. You know, we had so much more to do and so much more planned, and I, you know, I felt angry and robbed, and, you know, robbed for her children and her grandchildren. You know, I mean, it was just like a real kick in the teeth for our family. But it was her time. It was her time to go. And she's out of pain. She's out of struggle. She's happy. She's blissful. I've seen it. I know it. And because of that, and because I feel her presence around us so much and everyone else, I mean, it took her a while to come to Christine because Chris was really angry about it. But she came to the rest of us quickly and to comfort, especially my mother, but in that process, I had to accept my greatest fear, my singular greatest fear, was losing April. And it came to pass. I indulged that fear. For years and years, I was so afraid she would be the first to go. She had degenerative spinal disease. Her bones were literally collapsing into themselves. She was in terrible pain. She was taking too many prescription drugs to handle that pain. And ultimately, it was a prescription of oxycodone and fentanyl, a fentanyl patch, that stopped her heart. And it was given to her by her doctor, her surgeon, that was going to do surgery on her the next morning.
Wow.
And she never made it to the hospital because the stuff that made her feel better enough that she could function ultimately stopped her heart. And it broke mine, and it broke my family's heart. And, you know, I talk about it now because I just want people to know, if you're using fentanyl, please don't. Please find a substitute. Please find any other drug that will help you ease your pain, because that stuff is 50 times more potent than morphine. And it's 100% toxic, and it will make you feel better until it kills you. It's killing 9 people a day in this country. And let none of us make any mistake in thinking that our Congress is going to do anything about it, because, you know, all the lip service they want to pay, they can, but they're owned by the pharmaceutical industry and by the AMA, among other interests, and they're not going to do anything. We have to inform each other about the dangers, the hazards, the poison that's being fed to America. And, you know, if me saying that saves one life, then April will have not died in vain. So getting back to what I was saying, I want you to embrace your fear, because if you do, it will subside. It will go away. Just thank it for being a part of you. Thank it for every time it saved you from making a bad decision or doing something you shouldn't have done. And in terms of your fear of death, thank it, because every time you get that spark and that fear, for that moment, the adrenaline surges through you and you feel more alive for that moment. That's the purpose that it serves. And when it no longer serves that purpose and you want to claim your own personal power back, you will.
Andy, you said fentanyl?
I'm sorry, honey. I'm sorry, sweetheart. Fentanyl, F-E-N-T-A-N-Y-L. It's poison. It's toxic.
Okay.
I've had it before in an ambulance, and I can see why people get addicted to it. It's the scourge right now. I mean, like you said, there's a bunch of people dying, and it's kind of the big thing because it's more powerful than heroin, and people are getting, you know, taking the same amount of fentanyl that they might with heroin, and they're ending up dying, or it being used with other things like benzodiazepines, like Xanax and Valium. It's just bad news.
Yeah, it's bad news all the way around, as are most of the pharmaceutical drugs that are on the market. I avoid them like the Black Plague. But, you know, I mean, I thank God for Motrin. It saved me through this horrible, you know, God bless Mucinex. You know, I'm like, I am all for Mucinex. Oh, my God, that's why I can even talk to you right now. But,
it sounded like I could tell by the way behind your words. It's like, oh, my God, she's almost like ready to get to you got hit by a Big Mac, and it's like you're just barely functional.
Oh, this has been a terrible illness. This has just been hell on wheels. But
I feel myself coming out of it. Besides hearing voices, and I'm sure that, you know, things, like you said, things are being touched. Was there anything unusual or something out of the ordinary that you saw or experienced that you can share with our listeners? Like, was there anything like you can see things flying or levitation or anything like that?
And what are you referring to specifically, at the farm?
Your experiences at the farmhouse.
Oh, honey, I wrote 1,500 pages of experiences at the farmhouse. Oh, my God. It takes like a week to read it if you don't do anything else but sleep and eat. Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, you know, the Conjuring barely scratched the surface. There isn't a single scene in The Conjuring that comes directly from our experiences, from what I call a collective memoir. And I'm glad for that because now I'm completely free to make my films without duplicating anything. But, yes, there were countless incidents. I didn't even include everything in the books because at a certain point it would just become redundant. You know, at a certain point, what I would do is I'd put in a line like, you know, this particular incident or something akin to it happened hundreds of times when we lived at the farm. You know, when I talked to Cindy, Cindy died when she was 2 months old. She was born with a terrible birth defect, a hemangioma on her face. And they had to stop the bleeding because it was just filling up into this huge blood sac on her face, bless her little heart. And so they had to stop the bleeding, and they had to cauterize all the vessels that were feeding this tumor on her face. And so she crossed, and they brought her back. And we all believe that that's why Cindy was targeted so much in the farmhouse. It was my mother predominantly and Cindy predominantly that had the most experiences at the farm. And, you know, even though I can say that I considered it the best 10 years of my life because of what I learned and what I saw, Cindy says it's her worst 10 years. But it certainly did open her.
Andrea, is it because, like, the spirits, they're just like you and I, they pick out people they like and don't like. Is that correct?
I think so. I think that they seek out people that they feel some kind of specific connection with. And in that case, you know, it would certainly mean that that was my whole entire family. As Jason was talking about earlier, you know, or you were, Terry, about destiny. You know, I think that, you know, if there is such a thing, then we were destined to live at that farm and to have these experiences and to share them with the world. My mother said when I started writing the book that I was doing the right thing because this was not the kind of story that one should rightfully take to the grave. You know, this is empirical evidence of proof of the fourth dimension, of another space and time that exists beyond our realm as we know it in a 3D, five-sensory world. So, you know, yeah, I mean, Cindy had the voices that started right away. She was completely surrounded in her bed. It was within the first or second night of being in the farmhouse, and she and Christine were in the middle bedroom. I had the room that was directly over the parlor, and Nancy and April had the room that was over the kitchen. So there were three huge bedrooms on the top floor of the house, and all the doors were open between them. It was the only way to have any heat passing through up there. So, you know, we weren't shut off from each other. And yet Cindy was blown away that I could not hear what she was hearing. And these voices were all around her bed. She never saw anybody attached to the voices. She never saw an apparition that was actually making the sound. But what she heard was a mantra, a chant, over and over and over again. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. And when they would start, they would get louder and louder and louder, and she would come into my room shaking and crying and say, "The whole house is shaking. The floors are shaking. How can you not hear them?"
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and Christine in the same room with her, "How can you not hear this?" You know, and she would lay in bed and cry and cover her head with her pillow, and get any more, she'd come bolting into my room. And over time, she got used to it. And, you know, she would even just say, "Okay, I know you're telling me. I know what you're telling me. I can't tear the wall apart. I can't, you know, just please stop. Just leave me alone and stop and let me go to sleep. And then they would simmer down and they would quiet down and they would go away. But it took her connecting with them. That they were just reaching out to her because she could hear them. And I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if that somewhere on that property, whether it be the back wall to the house or the wall to the garden spot or somewhere around that property, I wouldn't be even remotely surprised to discover that there are seven soldiers that are buried on that property. That house was built before the Revolutionary War. The house was completed 40 years before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It survived through the Door Rebellion. It survived through countless border skirmishes. It survived through the Revolutionary War, through the Civil War. It was part of the Underground Railroad for years because the Arnold family that owned it were Quakers and they were abolitionists, and they were using it because it was so remote to get people up, funneled up into Canada. You know, it was, it has an incredible, incredible history, you know, so, and I would say the vast majority of which we don't even know. So it's in terms of, you know, who these spirits were in particular, Mrs. Warren is the one that said it was Bathsheba Sherman, but Bathsheba Sherman never even lived in that house. She had some attachment or connection to it. And according to the town historian that we met when we moved there, she was accused of harming and killing a baby in that house that she was either babysitting, or we don't know the background to that. You know, Mrs. Warren intuited that and said, this is the spot, this is the place, this is where it happened. Do you know that there was an inquest in the town of Chepachet because the town of Burrillville was not even incorporated yet when that all came to pass. And the town historian is the one that told my mother about that. It was the people of the town that said that she was a practicing witch, that she killed the baby, you know, for eternal youth and beauty, made this pact with the devil, yada, yada. You know, 100 years before that, those words would have gotten her killed. And instead, it got her tried and convicted and punished lifelong in the court of just the people are the ones that the people that lived around her made her life miserable, turned her into a miserable human being. But she was not the one, you know, in the court of public opinion, she was tried and convicted. But she was absolutely not that was haunting and taunting my mother. The one that was going after my mother in that house was more ancient, certainly, and was dead long before Bathsheba Sherman was ever born. And she had a broken neck. She died of a broken neck. It was clearly obvious. And Bathsheba died from in 1885 from a stroke and paralysis, her organs shut down. So, you know, it was just mischaracterized and misrepresented in the film and in every other place in the world because everybody wants to focus on Bathsheba because Mrs. Warren said so. And Mrs. Warren was wrong about that. The spirit that was coming after my mother spoke in kind of a almost broke English that was that usage, that language usage, was already out of use during the time of Bathsheba, who lived from 1812 to 1885. This was someone who was probably, if not the original mistress of the house, certainly one of the first women who were the lady of the house. And she hated my mother. And we don't know why she hated my mother, but she did. And she came to my mother one night and leaned into her face and said to her, 'Twas mistress once afore ye came, and mistress here will be anon. We'll drive ye out with fiery broom. We'll drive ye mad with death and gloom.' these are words that those words, you know, that's an expression of intelligence. That's an expression. That's not a ghost going, oh, get out. That's thoughtful, rhythmic, lyrical language, poetic in nature. I cannot explain why it was. The whole incantation was quite long, and it took my mother being hypnotized to reveal it. And I write some of it, not all of it. Some of it's been lost, and my mother will not, absolutely will not undergo hypnosis again. She's like, screw it, I don't care. You know, whatever you've got, that's fine. She said, I'm not going through that again. And I don't blame her. She's 78 years old. She gets to say no, you know, but I have enough of it between what she remembered, what Nancy remembered, what Christine remembered, what Cindy remembered, what my father remembered. I've got enough of it to give you the gist of it. And the gist was, get out or ye too will soon be dead.
Sounds like something I'd hear from a movie from like a gypsy curse or a witch or something. It's pretty dark,
yeah,
pretty scary.
It is, you know, and I mean, Mrs. Warren's like, you know, Bathsheba was a witch. Well, there's no evidence anywhere, recorded anywhere, that Bathsheba was a practicing witch. You know, Bathsheba had a husband and she had four children, three of whom died before the age of four. You know, she's lived a very long and a very sad and in many ways a miserable existence. And she was born of the Fair and the Taft family, two very prominent families in Rhode Island, both associated with Brown University. How she ended up in the backwoods of Harrisville, I will never know. Nobody will, not in this lifetime. But she ended up marrying Judson Sherman, and she lived on the Sherman farm, which was about maybe a mile away from our farm, the old Arnold estate. And she copped the blame for everything. She did, you know. So not only was she, I am her great defender because there's no proof. I don't think that you should go around telling somebody that someone's a murderer if you don't know that for sure. You know, that just seems like, you know, totally irresponsible. So I'm her great defender, and even though I cannot absolve her of what she was accused of, and ultimately it never even went to a trial. There was an inquest, and the judge said there's no evidence here that this young woman did anything. You know, I mean, if you think about, you know, children died accidentally all the time back mm-hmm. then. You know, I mean, everybody made their own clothing. There were sewing baskets everywhere. You know, what if this was, we don't even know how old this child was, if it was a toddler and fell into a sewing basket and the needle got impaled into the base of its skull, which is what the doctor found when the baby died and its cause of death was listed as convulsions. That's what the historian told us. And he was 10 years old when she died. He was a very old man when we met him, Mr. McEachern. And he's the one that told my mother about Bathsheba and the stories of her, and he's also the one that told her about Mrs. John Arnold that decided to hang herself in the barn in the 1700s, and that was hidden in the town records because suicide was considered such an aberration that, you know, you couldn't, if you committed suicide, you couldn't even be born, you know, buried in hallowed ground. So, you know, chances are really good since that was the hanging that supposedly happened on the property, that it was Mrs. Arnold that resented my mother's presence and felt that she was some type of competition in the household. But we'll never know for sure. All I did in the books was say, this is what Mr. McEachern told my mother, you know. And see, to me, it doesn't even matter who they are. And I'm sure that it matters to them who they are. But it doesn't matter to me because for me, just that they exist is a freaking miracle. You know, just that they exist is that spirit is real, is mind-blowing. It truly is. And yes, you know, there's been a belief in spirit that has existed as long as humankind has existed. You know, ghosts and spirits are written about in every major text that's ever, you know, been composed on this planet. This is not news to anybody, but it's always, for the most part, been considered rather taboo, not a subject that's discussed in polite company, and that makes people uncomfortable. Well, I say, you know, I won't talk to you about it unless it's something you want to talk about with me. I'm not here to make anybody uncomfortable. I'm here to do my part to impart what knowledge I have and to do what I can to enlighten anyone within earshot. And that's my job.
Do you think there's a way to help these spirits? I know there's people out there saying that they do these spirit rescues where they go in and perform a ritual or do whatever they do and cross these spirits into the light. Do you think there's any truth to that, or are these spirits just destined to roam the earth for eternity?
Well, you know, I don't cast dispersions or disparage what anybody else is doing in the field unless I see them deliberately and openly provoking. That I have zero tolerance for, because I think it shows an inordinate disrespect for the dead. You know, my mother, once she realized our house was haunted, said, you know, you always have to be respectful because this was their house first. And she was right about that. You know, she said that they were somehow attached to the house. They weren't just passing through. You know, that there was something about that house that kept bringing them back, or perhaps, like, the moon, they were there all along, and then the night of the full moon, which coincidentally is shining down upon me right now, because I'm sitting outside, it's 70 degrees, it's Florida, oh yay, but you know, on the night of the new moon, we don't doubt that the moon is still in the sky, we just can't see it, you know, so I think that the spirit realm is very similar to that. I would think that there's a causal relation to what's visible and what's invisible and still existing. We don't see the air that we breathe. We don't doubt that we breathe air. So in that respect, I would say ultimately we just have to decide what we're comfortable with. And I am supremely comfortable with the idea that spirit exists. And I am completely surrounded by spirit all the time, and I see numerous things that perhaps other people that were even in my company at the same time would not necessarily see, because they don't see multidimensionally, interdimensionally, extradimensionally. They don't see that way. They see three-dimensionally, and that's fine. Let them. That's perfectly fine with me. But I know that there are millions and millions and millions of us, countless millions of us on this planet, that have the ability to see beyond our 3D, 5 sensory realm. And whether it's because of exposure or because we are innately gifted with that, whatever the reason, and no one knows what the reason is, I have a responsibility to, you know, the phrase, if you see something, say something. Well, that applies to this study, to this field. You know, there's no science that exists currently that wasn't at one time considered a pseudoscience. So the study of paranormal activity, as it were, is, you know, lumped into that category now. But that's only because the body of proof, the body of evidence, has never been compiled in one place simultaneously. And I think that if everyone who has captured evidence and photographs that can be vetted and authenticated and EVPs that can be authenticated, if all of that information was in one place at one time, there wouldn't be a skeptic left on this planet, not one.
So what do you suggest?
There were...
Oh, go ahead, Jason.
I wish technology was to a point where we could get some answers. I just don't ever see that happening. I just, for some reason, to me, it's always going to be a mystery, almost like it's designed to be a mystery. It's the whole construct of life and everything is, you know, the duality of good and evil and all this. And it almost seems to me it's like a puzzle that can't be solved. It's always left us. It's always going to leave us having questions about everything. That's just what I think.
Well, and I think you're probably right about that. I don't think that we're supposed to have all of the answers. I really don't. I think that little droplets of clues get left like breadcrumbs in the forest, and they help us find our way home. But our home is not in this realm. And I think that part of the reason that it remains a mystery is because that's what piques our human curiosity so that we can evolve and we can grow and we can ascend spiritually into a belief that works for each one of us. And, you know, even atheism is a belief system. It's a belief that there is no God. You know, so when you look at the way the human mind functions in that respect, I think ultimately you come to the conclusion that there are some things that are supposed to remain secret, that there are some things that we will never answer, not in this realm, not until we pass on, and then perhaps we will be gifted with those answers on the other side, but perhaps not. In terms of crossing people, getting back to your initial question, Jason, it's not, and I do think of them as people, you know, they're just in a different dimension. It's not something I would do. I don't perceive that to be our job. I think that everything happens with purpose and reason, and if they're here, there's a reason. I don't think that, you know, as well-intended as it might be, and what we perceive to be altruistic on our part to help them cross to the light, that's not our job. At least I don't perceive it to be. And if they're here to make their presence known so that others, so that those who encounter them can share that with others and enlighten others, then they serve an incredibly valuable purpose during the time in which they spend in this realm. If they are trapped in this realm, that's not a conclusion that anyone can make with any certainty. You know, what we end up doing is relying on the religious texts. You know, there's, according to the Catholics, there's heaven, there's hell, there's purgatory. You can fall into this realm, you can go down, you know, with the devil, or you can rise with the angels, or you can be stuck in between ad infinitum until God decides, yada, yada. I don't know. I don't think that way. I think in a much more, I guess, in a much more universal way. I don't think of God as God. I think of God as what the Pleiadians refer to as the firm creator. And I don't assign a sex to it. I think it's the infinite intelligence and the divine mind of the universe, and that we all tap into it, and that we're all a living, breathing expression of it while we're on this planet, which is a vast classroom, and we are the way, all the living creatures of the planet are the way in which the Creator sees its creation. And that's how I think of it. So that's my belief system in a nutshell. And that is contrary to virtually all religious texts. And I don't, you know, I think that if the Jesus, Mary, Joseph thing happened, chances are really good. And the only way that that makes any plausible sense to me at all is that Jesus was an extraterrestrial that was implanted in this woman and was sent with a message for the world. And we killed him because he was too full of light and love. And he was a threat somehow. You know, but that's what makes sense to me. And some people listening to this will go, okay, she's off her rocker. But that makes sense to me. And I'm allowed to feel the way that I do and think the way that I do in the same respect that everyone else is as well. I only ask people to keep an open mind. That's all that I ask, to consider the possibilities You know, because if our family experienced this and not one of us ever said, oh, we have the answer to everything. No, we do not. I just turned 59 years old. I saw my first full body apparition when I was 12 years old, and I can't tell you any more today, as I'm rounding the corner to 60, than I did when I was 12, what exactly it was that we saw. But I can tell you what we didn't see. We didn't see something that was a figment of our imagination or an optical illusion or a mass hallucination. It wasn't that. It was something else. And it was just as real. The first time, the first full-body apparition I saw, I mistook as a living, breathing human being. He appeared that solidly to me. And then when I walked past him, I said, good morning, sir. By the time my sister Nancy came into the kitchen, she leaned over and told Cindy that the man that was standing with Mr. Kenyon just disappeared right in front of her eyes.
Wow.
And that
was,
you know, well, hello, welcome to our world.
And that would make me a believer. Sorry, Cherry, go ahead.
Andrea, what kind of suggestions would you have with somebody living with spirits like that and what you had to go through? What kind of advice or suggestions?
Well, if they don't, you know, it wasn't, things didn't really calm down in that house until we all, including my father, acknowledged them and tried to live peacefully with them. And, you know, I wouldn't suggest that for anybody else, you know, because that's not my place to do that. I think everybody has to deal with their situation. They're dealing with different spirits, with different agendas, different characters, you know, so, I mean, unless I am intimately familiar with someone else's story and what, you know, what I can, you know, my sensory perceptions of their particular abode or, you know, whatever they're dealing with, sometimes the attachments are to the people themselves. They think they live in a haunted house, they move, and then they say, oh, great, I've just moved into another haunted house. Well, it's not the house, honey, it's you, you know, so you have to decide if you want that kind of connection with that particular spirit or if you want to sever it. And, you know, there are a number of people who are working in this field that can help others do that. I'm just not one of them. I have a tendency to complicate things. I tell people all the time, stop inviting me on investigations because I skew your results. Not only can I not touch any of your equipment at all because immediately I will drain the batteries dead, but on top of that, I bring my own entourage with me. And so what you might be picking up are the spirits that are attached to me. Now, that's
Wow. Causing
any problem. And I don't have any issue with them. I live in a haunted house right now. There's an old man named George that built this house. And every medium I know, Rick, and oh, my God, all my medium friends, they walk in the house and they're like, you know, there's a spirit in this house, right? I'm like, yeah, his name is George. Blah, blah. He doesn't like me. He does like Dad. He thinks Dad is fabulous, and I'm just a loudmouth feminist, and he doesn't like my language, and he doesn't like how I set up the kitchen, and he doesn't like this, and he doesn't like that, although we've made peace. We have. I swear to God, I'm going to turn him into a feminist before I leave this house. I am. He's getting quite the education on the other side, let me tell you. But anyway, that aside, I've had way too much coffee and way too much NyQuil, so I apologize for this whole interview.
Well, we're,
no, you don't have to apologize at all.
No, this has been
goodness.
Great, and it's always a
so
great pleasure to have,
one,
have you on.
House of Darkness, House of Light, you're actually going to be in whatever you wrote in that particular volume, and we're going to talk about how people can get that book. That's you're going to do it in pieces, like you said in the beginning.
Well, there's three books, House of Darkness, House of Light, Volume 1, Volume 2, Volume 3. They're all available on Amazon. In fact, Amazon runs them on sale a lot where you can get all three books for a special price. Or you can download them. You get the whole set for like less than $15 in an electronic download. They're, what do they call it? I can't remember the word they call it, but they're made for all the different e-readers. They have to, you know, change the script for each and every one of them, but they're formatted. They are formatted to all of the different e-readers that are available on the market. So it's easy to get, and I tried to do it in such a way that it was affordable because, you know, these volumes are 500 pages a piece. And,
wow,
you know, it's it is no easy read. It's not. I wrote these books for people who were ready for them. I wrote these books for people that had already been touched by spirit. I wrote these books for a very sophisticated thinker and reader. I didn't dumb this story down, not one iota. In fact, it's funny because, you know, people are like, oh, God, you know, it doesn't follow exactly chronologically. I'm like, suspend the notion of linear time. From the moment we step on that farm, volume one starts chronologically and brings you up to when we move to the farm. But really, from that point on till 10 years later when we leave, just know that whatever you're reading happened during the course of those 10 years. There might be a chapter with, there's 10 chapters total spread out over three books and a multitude of sub-chapters. So in one story might be something that happened to my sister Nancy when she was 10. And the next story might be something that happened to Nancy when she was 14. And the reader's like, whoa, wait a minute. You just skipped 4 years. You know, no, I didn't. Read the stories and look at the correlation between the two of them and let that absorb, knowing that this happened on that property in the 1970s, you know, and it, what that does, what that process does is it actually, it's like blowing up a balloon. It actually expands your consciousness. And in terms of the way that you look at our experiences, and what it actually does is draw you into the experience so that you can have it with us. It's not something that I did deliberately. I was guided to write these books the way that they came out of me. And, you know, I credit the spiritual intervention with it, but what it does allow the reader is to be lost in that same sense of timelessness that we had when we were living at the farm. You never knew if you were in the 1700s, the 1800s, the 1900s. You know, you just didn't know. You know, and what Jason had said earlier about, you know, my sister Cindy, when I was talking with her and making notes and putting her stories into the memoir, she said to me one time, the scariest thing of all about living at the farm was not knowing what was coming next. That was the unknown factor. You didn't know if you heard footsteps coming up to your bedroom door, if it was mom coming to get you for dinner, or if it was something else entirely. And it was that she found most unnerving.
That would be totally unnerving. And I just looked at the clock here, and we're out of time. But I want to thank you so much, Andrea, for coming back on. And it's always been a great pleasure to have you on Paranormal Horizons.
Thank you so much. And also, anybody that's interested in Jack the Ripper, I have a new book out with George Lopez called In a Flicker. And it is the most compelling read that you will ever, I mean, strap yourself in. It's a wild, wild ride. And I invite everybody to look at our website, inaflickernovel.com. If you're into Jack the Ripper and time travel and all of that, it will blow your mind. So, yeah, I got 4 books out. I'm working on the screenplays, and I'm off and running. So now I'm going to go throw myself in bed and recuperate from this horrible illness. And I thank you both with all my heart for having me on your broadcast tonight. I love you both.
Well, we thank you so much for just spending the time. It's always a pleasure to have you. And I know, Andrea, you are so busy. It's just, you're phenomenal, and it's just a pleasure to have you. And we'll have you on air next year for sure. We'll make sure that we set aside a date and we get you back on.
Oh, great. Next time, all we're going to talk about is extraterrestrials, my other life.
Hey, that'll be good. That'll be Yay!
Right up my alley. Now you're talking my language. I'm all about
Yeah.
the movies.
I like talking about all that stuff, so it's great. We'll have you back and talk about terrestrial. So,
that's
but thank
right.
you, Andrea. I hope you're feeling good. We both love you too, and we, you know, stay in touch. And if you ever need us, give us a quick shout. Okay.
Okay. Take care. Thank you.
There,
good
girl.
Night.
Okay. We'll talk to you later.
Good night.
Okay.
Hope you feel better.
Bye. Thanks, honey. Bye bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, it's great to have her. Hope she feels better. Oh, my. She's, you know, it's so bad to get sick and catch anything that's going around, especially when you're sick and people are sick and exposing other people. It's just, oh, terrible.
Makes me want to get a flu shot. You know, everywhere where I work, because I work in the medical community, you know, we're supposed to get flu shots. And if you don't, you have to wear a mask. And I've never had the flu, and I never get sick, so I've never been compelled to get a flu shot. So it's time to think about getting a shot, because it's that time of year where we have to get our shots, and maybe I should. I don't know.
Well, it's, and also, too, like Andrea, she, as much as she travels, you know, internationally, it's in a plane, you know, you're all that air that's inside the airplane is all recycled. It's not like you're breathing in fresh air. You're traveling and getting some circulation. If there's any virus or anything going on in the air, it's very easy to catch it, too. It could be airborne or bacteria-borne. So it's just this time of year. It's terrible. Hospitals, children, your doctor's offices, very grocery stores, yeah, they're a feeding zone for that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, we better wrap it
okay.
up. We're a little bit
next,
over here.
We're going to have quickly, we're going to have Neil McNeil. How's it going? And a little bit tongue-tied. Neil is a paranormal investigator, and he's up in upper crest of Washington State. He is the founder of Paranormal College. And we're going to have him and talk about, I'm not sure quite, but he's a second-time returning guest, very well-known in the paranormal field up in Washington. And I'll get a hold of him, and we'll figure out a subject that we haven't covered on Paranormal Horizons and with him. And it's going to be an exciting show. So we're looking forward to having him back for the second time next week.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, want to wish everybody a safe and happy week, and thank our stations that rebroadcast the show on Thursday, 106.5 KITC FM and 107.3 KNCP. And with that, unless you have anything else, Sherry, we'll see everybody next Sunday, 8 p.m. West Coast time for that episode you're talking about.
Yay! So I'm really excited, and yes, thank you. And any shows that I'm going to be doing, I'm actually going to be just marketing Paranormal Horizons. So I'm really excited getting our name out there even further. And we're just excited for this coming new year, because we're going to have bigger opportunities. And I'm just really excited with everything going on with our lives. It's going to be great. You starting a new job. You know, things are really, they're going to be very positive. So I'm really looking forward to a positive note next year.
Absolutely. And with that, I hope everybody has a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Take care, everybody. We love you. Peace.